We are going to call the Property Tax and Local Sales Tax Division to order, and I would like to welcome everyone back after our interim. And I also would like to make some introductions of new people and so forth working with the committee. And we have new DFL research over here, Brooke Bortson. Thank you for joining the division. We also have our pages this year, our Charlie Moberg and David Stuberg. So thank you so much. Before we get going, I also would like to say we have some guests from the Red River Emerging Leadership Program. So thank you so much. They're in the blue shirts with the L. And these are leaders that have been designated by their peers in the various rural communities around the state. And up front here is Eric and Shanna Clint from Wilkin County, who are constituents of mine. So welcome all. And today we are going to hear a report from the state auditor, Rebecca Otto, who is going to talk about city finances. And before we start that, I would really like to thank this auditor for all of your work last year as we were looking at some of those bills and looking at city reform and accountability and value and efficiency, and your help in, although we didn't get this into law, but your help in setting up the framework and being willing to kind of really serve as the leader on all of that was greatly appreciated. So I thank you so much for that. Members, I also want to remind you that if you're thinking about doing bills, that you have to meet a certain criteria. In fact, I'm already needing to rework a few of the ones I was thinking about introducing. But remember, any bill this year, if first of all, if it adds to the budget deficit, don't think about introducing it. It will not be heard before the committee. Then the bill has to, besides that it can add to the budget deficit, it has to meet one of the next five, and that is it has to either help solve the state budget deficit, or it has to redesign some part in local government, or it has to make sure it increases value to the taxpayer, which is increasing value, better results, better value at a better price, or it lowers property taxes for citizens. So it needs to meet that. Now, if you have a bill that already has been introduced and it doesn't meet that criteria, if ahead of the meeting before the hearing, or as you do a hearing request, if you have a proposed amendment that will now change it to meet this, I will accept that too, because you might have one that. So, for example, if there's one that doesn't meet that, maybe if there's a requirement or an amendment that you would say, okay, we are going to measure results somehow of how these dollars will impact that, that would be hopefully at least being able to measure some results. So think about that as you introduce those bills. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to State Auditor Rebecca Otto, and the floor is yours, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor. Some of you gave me a look when you saw the report, and I told Representative Detmer I expect you to read this by tonight and be able to take a quiz in the morning. It's it's a lot of numbers, it's a lot of information. And so what I'm going to do today is I want to give you the 30,000-foot view of city government in the state of Minnesota, and I'm going to focus more on some trends, looking over the last 10 years and kind of what's happened for them, and then I'll be available for questions, okay? All right, just so you know, the reports, all of our finance reports contain executive summaries at the beginning, and so page 3 and page 4 have the executive summary. I try to provide you with highlights that I think are important for you to know, and then it gives you page numbers to reference to that information. What I'd like to do today is start you on page 5. Are the screens on? Oh, good. Page 5. And walk you through a few things. So our report breaks down the data by cities over 2,500 and cities under 2,500 in population, okay, because there are differences. And there's two central differences in a couple different respects. Cities under 2,500, which are smaller cities, are much more dependent on intergovernmental revenues, which would be like federal and state aids, local government aids. It's 33% of their revenues than cities over 2,500. Okay, so that's one difference. Second difference is the reliance on tax revenues. Because large cities receive a much smaller portion of their revenues, about 17%, from intergovernmental revenues, they're more commonly utilize tax revenue streams like TIF, franchise, lodging, and local sales tax. So there's some differences in their revenue streams. All right, property taxes account for a similar share of total revenues for these two groups of cities. For large cities, property taxes accounted for 35% of total revenue, so that's the revenue pie, compared to 30% for small cities. But if you look at them as a whole, all cities, property taxes accounted for 35% of total revenues. All right. Now what I'd like to do on the same page of five, there's an expenditure section. This is, again, 30,000-foot view. Both large and small cities, their biggest expenditure is public safety and streets and highways. So that's the nature. That's what they spend the most money on. And then let's see here. And then it breaks down the differences between the two. All right, now what we're going to do is go to page 7, please.
Ms. Otto,
yes?
Would you like us to wait to ask questions or on your segment, or would you want to entertain those as you go along?
Mr. Chair, if I could do that 30,000-foot view, and I'm very happy to go back if that's okay with the members.
Very good.
And then I'd be happy. And then they can at least get the whole picture, if that's okay.
That sounds very good.
Okay, great. So on page 7, this is on page 7, we're looking at 10-year trends. All right, so we're going to go to, first of all, over between 99 and 2008, when you look at city finances and you adjust them for inflation, the revenue levels are below, except it's not this chart, I'll show you another chart, but they're below 99 levels. 2008 revenue levels are below 99 levels when you factor in inflation, which is an interesting point.
Ms. Otto, can you adjust that so we can see the entire... There you go.
And this is a different figure, actually. I've got a figure that will show this. This is another figure I'm going to move on to. But if you adjust revenues for inflation and you look back between 99 and 2008, they decreased by 7%. So this graph right here, figure one, is important because this looks at primary sources of city revenues as a percent of total revenues between 99 and 2008. The line with the circles is property taxes, and the line with the triangles is intergovernmental revenues. That's your state aids and your federal aids. And what's happened since about after 2003 is as the triangle line goes down, as intergovernmental revenues, state aids, local government aid, and federal aids have decreased, there's been a mirror image of property taxes increasing. So they've been replaced with property taxes. Now, when we issued the report this year, if you look between 2007 and 2008, there's been an acceleration in that trend line, which I thought was important for you to know. So it's accelerated. Something I want to point out, this is through 2008. Okay, this is audited financial information that we used. This does not take into account any changes in 2009. So the situation of cities could have changed since this time. But because the trend line has accelerated in both directions, I thought that would be something that you'd be interested in. Okay, what I'd like to do now is go to page 8. This was that line I was talking about. If you take, go over that 10-year period of time, 1999 to 2008, and you look at revenues in actual dollars, which is the circle line, and then you look at constant dollars, that's inflation-adjusted dollars in revenues. There has also been an acceleration here. Inflation-adjusted dollars have actually gone below the 1999 levels when you adjust for inflation. If you look at the actual dollars, between 7 and 8, actually there's a little bit of decline there too. So in both analyses, they have gone down. All right. Now on page 9, this is our 30,000-foot view. I wanted to bring your attention to table 1. This is over the 10-year period of time, and the change is over two five-year periods of time. With city revenues, this is inflation-adjusted, okay? And again, interesting, state grants down 33%, taxes up 20%. This is a change over time. So you can spend time, if you'd like, on that graph. I just wanted to point it out, or that table, excuse me. If we, let's see here, let me go to figure 3, which is on the same page. This is expenditures, growth in expenditures. Again, we'll take the actual dollars, which is the upper line, and then constant dollars. You factor in inflation. When you factor in inflation with expenditures over that 10-year period of time, expenditures for cities are 7% below what they were in 1999. And if you look at the actual dollars, the line actually increases. So again, it can paint a picture for you what's actually happening. Now what I'd like to do is, you can go now to page 10. And again, it's the same type of table except for expenditures. You, if you factor in inflation over that 10-year period of time, you can look at some of the different categories and what's occurred in them. And again, remembering that streets and highways and public safety are some of the larger expenditures for our cities. That's where they spend more money. And finally, I think I'm going to stop there. Try to give you the highlights. There's a lot of information, as Representative Garofalo is nodding. and I believe you probably have some questions. I brought along John Jernberg from my office today, who works very hard on these reports and works closely with the entities and does the analysis. So hopefully we can handle anything that you have for us.
Thank you. And are you also later on going to go into the fund balances and the debt service and those type of things?
Mr. Chair, I actually have a point on my outline that says unreserved fund balances if they ask.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to overwhelm you at first. I thought maybe we could take some general questions, and I'd be happy to help you with that unreserved fund balance question because there's typically a lot of questions.
Very good. Representative Garofalo, and we've seen some statistics here now and some trends, 5-year and 10-year trends. So, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I thank you for being here, Auditor, and I have to tell a quick story. Everyone here knows I like to pull little practical jokes every once in a while.
Uh-oh.
And so I had the biggest practical joke blow up in my face happened involving Auditor Otto. As we all know, I think Auditor Otto and Representative Dean have a history together, and I'm friends with Representative Dean. So on the floor one day, Representative Dean was working by himself, and the auditor was out there doing some business. And so I passed a note to a page saying, Auditor Otto, I'd like to talk to you for a second, please. Thank you, Representative Dean. And gave the note to the page, thinking this would be a great practical joke. I'd sit in the retiring room, watch her walk up to Representative Dean, and have them stare awkwardly at each other, and it'd be funny. The page goes up to the auditor and says, this note was given to me by Representative De La Forest. So not only did he blow the practical joke, he actually outed the wrong person.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that or not, but I just always thought that was a funny story. Thank you again for being here, Auditor. Just a couple of questions. One, in the adjusted for inflation remarks, we can see in the footnotes that we're using the implicit price deflator. Mm-hmm. If I was to compare that to personal income growth or CPI, what would be the difference in percentages to that, or if staff knows that?
Ms. Otto or whoever wants to explain the difference between implicit price deflator and other inflationary factors like personal income growth.
Mr. Chair, I understand the difference. I'm wondering if I was looking at the actual numbers, what would the differential be?
Mr. Chair, if you all would be willing to give me a little bit more money in my office, oh, he's laughing. He's not willing to. There's lots of things we could do. With that particular issue, we're using IPD for state and local government. CPI is really what consumers experience, what they purchase, and then IPD for state and local government really looks more at what government purchases and the pressures they have on them. That's the really short version of it. I know there's lots of big articles written on it. It's what's in statute right now for, you know, local governments. It's what we use as we believe the right factor to use when factoring in inflation. And I guess, you know, you could slice and dice it both ways. We didn't do any analysis with CPI, so I can't specifically tell you what it would have done to the numbers had we. But we're, with our staffing that we have, which is very small, we use the factor that we believe is the correct one to use for this group.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Garofalo,
and again, just I think it's a fair statement without, you know, starting a battle. It's a fair statement to say that the implicit price deflator calculates inflation at a higher rate than would be other mechanisms we use in other parts of the tax code or in tracking our expenditures. It is a when we're talking about comparing things to inflation, I think it's a fair statement that the IPD is higher than those other indexes. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I think that's a fair statement. The other question I had is that you pointed out the chart on page 7, mm-hmm. Primary sources of city revenue as a percentage of total revenue, and you referenced in your comments that 2003 is being when we saw an increase in the trend lines. When I look at this, from 1999 to 2003, I see a 4% increase mm-hmm. In property taxes as a percentage, and from 2003 to 2007, I also see a 4% increase, so I'm wondering, what is it about 2003 that makes that be your reference point? As when I see 2003 to 2007 is the same as 99 to 2003.
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, I think we're crossing right around that period of time, and that's why I point that out where they start to, they cross over each other. Now, if you look at the property tax line, it had been increasing.
What chart number are we looking at?
I'm sorry, we're on page 7. I've got
page
it up
seven.
On the screen, and it's figure number 1. And it's the primary sources of city revenues as a percent of total revenues for the 10-year period of time. The intergovernmental revenues actually started dropping in 2002. There was a trend with property taxes going up. However, it accelerated between 7 and 8. And I'm just pointing out around that, right around 3, because that's when they crossed. And the intergovernmental revenues have continued to go down, and they've accelerated. So I guess as lawmakers, the reason why this may be important to you is because LGA is tied into that line that continues to decrease. And this is only through 2008, and it accelerated from 7 to 8. So knowing that more changed in 2009, as you make your decisions in this session, it's just something to keep in mind, because the trends are showing that as that goes down, the property taxes will most likely go up to replace that. So I hope I answered your question.
Yep. And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
I wanted to point out that the rise as a this chart specifically, the rise as a percentage of total revenues is really a trend that dates back to 99, not 2003. A little bit, as a conservative, I'm a little bit sensitive about when people reference 2003 as sort of the beginning point of alleged bad policy. So I'm just sensitive to that and want to point that out to the committee.
And Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you for your answers.
And Mr. Chair, and no disrespect, I was actually here then, Representative Garofalo, so I, you know, was in the middle of all that too, so thank you.
Ms. Otto, while we wait for other questions, as we look at the overall report, what would you see as some plus signs in trends coming out of this report, and maybe looking in terms of the state-local fiscal relationship or even the health of cities, some plus signs but also maybe some red flags? In your opinion as the state auditor, what would you see from your report, just kind of a general consensus there?
Mr. Chair, those are some great questions. I'll do my best to answer them. Some positives in the report. There are some positives in this report, which is the good news. Debt service payments have gone down. It doesn't look like they're issuing as much debt, so it looks as though they're trying to be prudent. That's good. Another positive sign is that the unreserved fund balances as a percent of current expenditures did not decline. They haven't. Now, again, this is them as a whole. Every entity can be in a slightly different situation. Some are in better shape than others, but they're not draining their unreserved fund balances necessarily, so that's good. They only went down by a small amount. And also, if you get a chance to have some entities testify, some of our entities work very hard to do prudent fiscal management, long-term financial planning, and I'll tell you a quick story. I work with Volunteer Fire Relief Association pension funds, and I've got a working group with the firefighters. And some cities who've always been good players, they work really hard, they plan, they were very surprised because some of them had to, you're asking about red flags too.
Right.
Well, there's additional pressures on cities right now, some of them unexpected, you couldn't have planned for. For instance, the investment markets went down, and this is a real pressure on some of our cities. They're having to make for the first time required contributions to their fire relief associations, and a lot of them were very upset. Some of them it's tuned to $2 million that they didn't get to budget for. And so they said, well, do we have to pay? Well, they have to. They have to levy for it if they don't have it. They don't want to raise property taxes. Is there any way we can get out of this? Well, we've got to make sure these pension funds are funded. So there's some pressures out there that they couldn't plan for, that they're having to deal with. And I got to talk to the CPA Society, people who also are auditing local governments. That's one. We got the foreclosure crisis as an overlay to this whole picture, okay? And some people losing their homes, that can affect cities' abilities to collect property taxes, and as home values decrease, you know, they may have to increase property taxes to, you know, overcome that. So there's a lot of interesting things. If a city has any OPEB liability, that can be another pressure for them in their budgets. And then local government aid cuts. There's been some pressure politically for cities to spend down their unreserved fund balances, which you wanted me to maybe address, and I'm happy to do that. There's a danger in that because cities are different than the state. They don't necessarily have a big rainy day fund that, you know, the state's drained there several times. They're a little bit different. They have to cash flow. They can have extra money for contingency, for emergencies. Some of them are in better shape than others. So that was, okay, you asked about red flags. You asked about positives. I tried to give you that. Did you ask about the fiscal relationship?
Yeah, I think just in general, what do you see in the last 10 years? I mean, I hear from, and I think we all hear from local units of government, and there's this kind of, they can't predict on certain things, and it seems to be actually a lack of trust between the state and the local.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is there any fixes you'd see, or do you see that? I guess just looking at the numbers, would there be reason for having kind of a sour taste in their mouth as they look at the state-local relationship? I mean, what's...
Do you want my honest opinion, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay.
Don't lie to us.
I promise I won't. You know, I get to travel the state. I have an opportunity to engage with lots of folks in greater Minnesota, slightly larger cities, very, very small cities. I get to talk to towns and counties, and I think the farther out I get, the more mistrust there is. I'll be very frank with you, because they're not as close, they're not here as much. Sometimes when I walk into a room, they'll say, the state is here. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. And some people think it's everyone in one small room and that we're doing bad things to them. And what I've really tried to do as a state auditor to say, look, I'm not the governor's administration, I'm not in a legislature, I'm independently elected, and I'm here for the people's best interest. But I also feel as though it's been my job to try to communicate with you, communicate with the public, because I'll tell you what I believe, and then you can tell me to be quiet if you want. I really believe that in the challenging times that we're in, that it is absolutely critical that state, local, and feds, that we are all communicating with each other and understanding what the challenges are and then figuring out how we find those solutions, as I was saying to Representative Lanning, that are the most sensible, common sense things we can do to allow local governments to collaborate. Let's like make lemonade out of these lemons. We're in a difficult situation. And really listen to each other. So I would say for local governments right now, you know, if they're getting cut in June or whenever it's going to be, I'm not sure they'll be able to make that up with increasing a levy. So they'll really have to cut it and figure out. Some will be in better shape than others. Some have very small budgets, some have bigger ones, some have more flexibility. I understand that there's a recommendation to cut all cities now. Some are not being held harmless in the governor's recommendation. But at the end of the day, if you want that trust, I'm sure there may be some local government groups in the room. It's that communication. And if we really have to do tough stuff, let's do some long-term planning about what it's going to look like so they can get their work done. I think it's harder for them to respond when it's a sudden thing and they have no way to adjust for it. When their main job is public safety and streets and highways. So,
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Auditor Otto, thank you for being here and for some good news. We all too often hear only the bad news. The good news in particular that you mentioned that I think is very significant is that debt is stable and local units of government aren't incurring more and more debt along the way. That certainly is good news, as well as the position of unallocated reserve. So that appreciate hearing that. This graph on page 7, I would urge that we be a little cautious about this. Very clearly there is a correlation or relationship between intergovernmental revenues and what you have to do with property taxes, to be sure. But there are also other factors that go into play here. Now, if you take a look at this graph from 2000 through 2003, property taxes appear to be going up at the same kind of rate that they were going up since 2003. And back in 2001, with the major tax reform, the legislature intended for the property taxes to go down. That's what they were trying to do, for the state to take more responsibility and property taxes to go down. They didn't. They went up. And, you know, when we look at the trend line here, there are two other very important factors that affect the trend line on property taxes. Number one, the growth in the tax base. As the tax base grows, there is more revenue that's coming to local units of government. As values on existing property increase, there's more revenue that's generated. And like I said at the outset, there certainly is a relationship between intergovernmental revenues and the level of property taxes, but there are other factors that go into play here too. And a question I would have, and maybe you'll get to this later, is what trend lines you see in other sources of revenue other than intergovernmental and property taxes. I mean, a lot of cities have other sources of revenue. What are you seeing there?
Auditor Otto?
John Turnberg. I'm a research analyst with the State Auditor's Office. A couple things in regards to this figure one showing the how the reliance on property taxes is going up and reliance on intergovernmental revenues is going down. Part of the goals of the property tax reform bill was to have to create a greater reliance on property taxes so that the citizens that are served by the services pay for the services. So it's really an alignment of what those that had planned the reform was. The reduction in property taxes was related to school district funding. That's the part that the state picked up. So the city, this graph here, it has more to do with the planned property tax reform results, which was make cities more responsible for spending decisions and having the citizens pay for those decisions. And so that's, I mean, that kind of reflects that. As far as other sources of revenue, the trend lines, there's certainly been a greater reliance on charges for services over this period of time. Some of that is a reflection on greater cooperation among local governments, because if the city of St. Anthony provides police protection for the city of Falcon Heights and the city of Lauderdale and another city, the city of St. Anthony collects charges for services that they're delivering to those cities. So you see those types of charges for services increase over this period of time. Tax increments have increased over time, and again, that's a small number of cities. I shouldn't say a small number of cities. That tends to be the larger cities rather than the smaller cities, because they have the the know-how to finance these to finance tax increment deals and things like that. So you see it much more with the larger cities over 2,500. Interest earnings have jumped up and down, so that's been a source of cities have been unable to plan for those big increases and decreases. I've noticed that for cities,
the interest earnings for over 2,500 decreased by 26% between 7 and 8, I believe. I'm on page 11, and this is information on cities over 2,500. So we do have, remember, we break the report into over 25 and under 25. So if you want to see revenues that grew at the greatest rate between 7 and 8, we've got that there. Yeah. Now, remembering, we have some very large entities in there that can kind of move the numbers quickly. So, and we try to account for for the large cities, hotel and motel taxes increased 76%, but the large increases in that and franchise taxes and the large decrease in sales tax categories primarily reflects a reclassification of revenues by the city of Minneapolis. So Minneapolis can really move numbers pretty quickly. And then there was a large increase in federal grants, which reflects assistance the city of St. Paul received to enhance security for the Republican National Convention. So there can be some bumps in some of these categories, and that's why sometimes these long-term trends are useful. And some of these numbers, there won't necessarily be trends. You know, interest earnings, we know that everything tanked, and that's affected them. But for a while, it was going quite well, but it's not a significant source of revenue necessarily. So,
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that further explanation. I was a city official back in 2001, and I put together a 2002 budget, and we received a substantial increase in local government aid from 2001 to 2002, and the legislature intended that we would lower property taxes as a result of that additional aid. It wasn't just the school tax, that was the big thing, but it was also part of the reform to take some pressure off the local property taxes with that tax reform as well. So I guess I wanted to clarify what you were saying here. It wasn't just about school funding that this reform was all about in 2001. It was also trying to take some pressure off local units of cities when it came to their property tax portion.
Well,
Mr. Junberg.
Oh, I'm sorry. HACA was reduced significantly, and then additional money was put into the LGA program. So certain cities did receive a greater level of LGA aid, but their HACA would have been reduced, and certain cities that didn't receive LGA would have just had reductions in HACA. So there were relationships like that were changed in the reform bill of 2001.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you for pointing out that different cities had a different result, and I happen to represent one that had the result I mentioned.
Yeah, and I think Representative Lanning, Mr. Junberg, bring up a great point in that major reform in 01, there was actually more HACA cut than LGA added, if I remember, but there were the regional centers like Moorhead and so forth that did get somewhat of a significant bump, so there was a difference there. And kind of the impact on counties and cities, if I remember, is that the tax bases were lowered because you saw some changes in the property classification rates for homeowners and businesses. So I know they had to increase their tax rates some to make up the sum. But overall, taxes from 02 to 03, or 01 to 02, went from $5 billion statewide to about $4.5 billion statewide. So taxes statewide went down about $500 million, but the school district portion went down about $1 billion. So all of it, and then because actually cities and counties probably raised some, as this chart shows, the net impact was like $500 million less. But the school district was where everyone saw most of it, as Mr. Junberg was saying, most of the property tax cuts. And then what kind of happened after that is a lot of it on that reform, and we've talked about this in the past, is that a lot of it wasn't permanent. I mean, you kind of put this stuff in, and one nice thing was is you tried to make things more accountable so that the property taxpayer could see more what was spent on the local level, kind of more of a direct impact. And I don't know if the intent of that ever came to fruition. Is there still that? I think we still need to tighten that accountability quite a bit. But one other thing that happened that didn't make it permanent happened really a lot on the referendum side with school districts, in the fact that equalized amount of value per student stayed the same. Well, those values went up tremendously. So at one time where you might have been only paying 20% share local and getting 80% equalization from the state almost disappeared over time. Representative Lanning, the Moorhead School District, when they passed that, 60-some million dollar debt service in, you know, one time, I forget what it was, but that almost vanished, and they saw huge increases because you're not inflating that equalization number, and it costs money to do that, of course, but so all of these things, you know, kind of added up. I had a question on these general fund reserves, and that you look at a small city on the average of about 89% of general fund reserves as of their budget, and larger cities about 46%. That hasn't changed a lot, at least from one year to the next. But you recommend about a 5-month level because primarily cities' revenues come in two big bunches during the year, primarily at two different times. So you need to have that money so you can get a cash flow. How would you rate the health of overall cities? Like, are there quite a few cities below this five-month balance? And on the other side, how would you explain cities that might be over 100% of their budget in general fund reserves? Talk a little bit about how you see, are cities generally, I know you get an average, but generally are they okay as far as cash flow? Are they also feeling the pinch like the state is? And kind of a little bit of cash flow and reserves, if you could combine those two items.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I'll try not to put you to sleep. You guys look like you're doing pretty well. Unreserved fund balances sometimes can be the great mystery. When we get calls from the media all the time, and we have lawmakers questioning sometimes our entities, well, don't you have a pot of cash you're sitting on here? And some people might look at an unreserved fund balance of 70% and say, well, you guys are way over what the state auditor says you should be. Because we have a range. But I want to draw your attention to page 317 of that big fat report that you have. This thing is so important, it doesn't take long to read. I'm not going to read it to you today. But it talks about factors influencing general and special revenue unreserved fund balances. And we have a range we recommend to local governments. But the circumstances of local governments can be slightly different. Our larger entities have more tools in their tool belt, so 20% unreserved fund balance may be very appropriate for a large city, where it would be very inappropriate for a really small one that only has a few sources of revenue. And so some larger entities sometimes can put off some expenditures, some different things they can do to make it through. Some small entities just don't have that flexibility. So what we tell local governments to do, just in case you want to talk to your entities, are they at an appropriate level? Are the ones that are at 50% at the exact right level? For some, it might actually be more than they need, and for some, it might not be enough. We tell them to have a policy on their unreserved fund balance. They should determine as an entity what's appropriate, review it each year to make sure as circumstances change. If the state's got a big deficit and it's got another large one coming, you might need a little bit more. This is something, the numbers we have in here are at the end of the year when they are flush. So it's a one snapshot in time measurement, and then they have to use that, the cash flow and all that, while they're waiting for payments or their chunks of change about twice a year. So John's going to take you through the table that actually we have a couple tables on unreserved fund balances. We have the one that ranks them from the highest to the lowest, and then we have one that ranks them alphabetically. So I'm going to let John speak and see if he has something he'd like to add.
Very good. Mr. Ginbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In general, in general of fund balances, those that we have the most concern with are those that have negative fund balances or below 35% of their current expenditures. That's when we get concerned. Those that have very large fund balances, as a percent of total current expenditures, we kind of look at them individually. And for example, on page 170, which is table 20, the city of Worthington shows a fund balance that's 337.9% of their total current expenditures. That is the result of a sale of a hospital. And so for this current year, they sold the building, the money was deposited, it's not reserved for anything yet, so they got this great big pool of money.
Okay.
That, if you go into, these individual cities, that may be the case, a sale of an asset, or a lot of times it's TIF districts where a TIF district is set up as a special revenue fund. They're collecting money to pay off bonds, but it's not in a debt service fund, and they don't have it reserved within that fund. I'm sorry about my voice. I've just been struggling with it. So a lot of times, it's the cities with the highest unreserved fund balances as a percent of current expenditure reflect unique circumstances, and without going into each one, it's hard to make a judgment. You kind of have to ask a particular city why their unreserved fund balance is so high. Sometimes, if there's a new development in a city, they will receive a big chunk of money that's supposed to go towards a park dedication fees, And that money gets set in a fund, in a special revenue fund, but it's not reserved at that point. It's not been spent. So that can boost up that figure. So there's a lot of reasons why cities may have particularly high fund balances. There's no justification for all of them. I mean, each city has to justify it on their own, and they should have a policy that says we want our fund, unreserved fund balance to be X percent of total current expenditures. But
I think, Mr. Junberg, you explained that well. So it could be an anomaly. I mean, we need to look at each situation. I know I've talked to mayors and officials from small cities who are saving $200,000-$300,000 for a fire truck. I mean, those things are expensive. Right. And they don't want to bond, so they're nestling away this cash, and that may be well over their budget for a year, and it's just how they, I guess, do it. Then they can spend it all at once, and so, Ms. Otto.
And Mr. Chair, that's right, because some of them don't want to issue debt.
Right.
They like to pay cash. That's their culture. And so there can be many, many explanations. There is a range that we recommend. They can be over it. They should be able to explain it. That's what we tell them, so... And Worthington, when I see anomalies like some of these, Worthington's a little bit bigger than some of the ones that are in the high range. And that one chart you said on page, or table on 169, 170, all those are ranked. And we sometimes will call and say, is that right? Are you sure? And they told John, well, yeah, because there was a hospital sale. And so as lawmakers, can you say, okay, anything over 50% is cash for us, we can cut them by that much? It's a little more complicated than that, if that's helpful.
Auditor Otto, I'm not going to have you rate the state as far as its unreserved balance and what it should be. But with things becoming tighter all the way around, as you do your city audits, have you seen more cities working together, consolidating services and efforts to save costs? What do you see out and around the state as far as, and we're going to be talking about redesign in here and doing those type of things. What's out there?
Mr. Chair and members, I would say just from my experience in the legislature, working with cities, talking with folks, there's been some that have been in survival mode for a while, and so they've done more collaboration, joint powers. I've heard of some police departments kind of merging, fire departments, consolidations. I believe there may be more of that, and so... I had a couple lawmakers say, would you be willing to chair a task force that brings together all local governments and their unions and figure out, is there ways that the legislature can loosen some things up so they can do more with shared services and all that good work? I'm happy to do it if the bill gets through. It's not really going to cost anything as long as local government groups can work on it and see, even schools, you know, are there things that you can do that will help them do more with collaboration, cooperation, shared services, best practices? There is good work going on. And there could be more, I would imagine. And again, I think local officials, many of them are doing it for survival. Mm-hmm. So,
members, questions? Representative Woffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Jernberger, or Rebecca Otto. Auditor Otto, I'm surprised when I looked at the enterprise tables, and I was just kind of, can't skim 800 tables, but I'm noticing how many of them have negative net income. And when I started to kind of drill down, I mean, I can understand how somebody can have a bad year in the liquor store or something reflecting the economy, but I'm surprised that a large number of negative and sometimes significant negative balances for both water or, in particular, sewer. And enterprise services in general are supposed to kind of break even and not be a transfer to the property taxes. Are we starting to see more cities trying to use property taxes to subsidize what typically would be an enterprise as an actual financial strategy? They think it's their residents are more accepting of property taxes than sewer increases, or I was surprised to see as many negatives as I did.
Yeah, I go ahead, Mr. Jernberg.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I don't know that there's been a trend for more net losses within enterprise funds. In general, we expect when they are selling commodity water, electricity, things like that, that they certainly are at least breaking even because they have something to measure as, for the service, they should be able to set the rates so that they break even. A lot of times it has to do with depreciation. If you look, they have enough, they're bringing in enough money to cover their current operating costs, but not their, but when you throw in depreciation, especially for something like a sewer system, that's when you get net losses. Certain cities make the decision for like a community center that they are going to subsidize that community center to a certain extent, and that's a decision that they've made. And nursing homes, hospitals, things like that, you will find a greater level of subsidization for those entities because they're providing some charity care and things like that that aren't covered through charges. But things for sewer, water, electric, refuse, I would expect them to be breaking even. And it is surprising when you see that they're not. And that's usually something that we would recommend, that they raise the rates to cover, mm-hmm. to at least break even.
And Mr. Chair?
Yep.
So really, in summary, a lot of these things they do collect fees for. Sometimes there's things they couldn't collect enough fees for, so they subsidize it. And it may be something the community feels is very important, so they can subsidize above and beyond the fees if they choose. And they, again, should have a policy. We always tell them to have a policy. So you set those levels, and if they're not adequate, then you have to determine, is it still in the public's best interest to have it? Water, sewer, you have to have. But there are some other enterprises, like liquor stores, that if they're constantly a loser, it may not be in the public's best interest, and they're required to hold public hearings. So,
looking at figure number one, you know, with the state having tough budget times and with cuts to local government aid and that type of thing, do you see that trend continuing that we see on, I guess, figure number one, which is on page 7? Do you see that continuing where there's a larger percent of property taxes of the budget? And I mean, it's whoever wants to, do you see that continuing, widening?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I based on the governor's supplemental budget and what we see going forward, I would expect this trend to continue. Either cities will have to significantly cut back on services, spend down their fund balances, or this trend will continue. I mean, that's state, you know, the level of state aid that they receive is most likely going to continue to go down. And if they're going to fund things at the current level, they have to find another source of revenues, whether that's property taxes or spending on their fund balances or reducing expenditures. But something has to give there.
I have one more general question. Auditor Otto, pretend you are Dr. Otto.
Okay.
And in comes a patient, and it's cities. And you're taking the blood pressure and the heart rate and so forth. First of all, how good a health is this person? And if not, what would you tell this patient to do into the future?
Okay, Mr. Chair, you're putting me in an awkward position. My handwriting is as bad as a doctor, but I decided not to be a doctor. I would say this. Minnesota tends to be a very great state. We tend to have better policies than most states. When I do national conferences, I'm always proud to be from Minnesota. So I'll tell you that. And again, there's some positive things in this report, and there's some trends in this report that we felt were important for you to know. We have some cities that are probably close to the edge. We've got some counties that are very close to the edge, and they don't have enough in reserves. And what I really don't want to see as the state auditor, and I don't think it's in the public's best interest, is for our local governments, our cities, to run into financial crises. Now, the state's been bumping along in financial crises now since 2003. There's been serial deficits, and it's difficult. And I know you have a very difficult job. I don't want our local governments getting put into the same position and going into crisis mode. They still have, some of them still have cushion. They're still in pretty good shape. They are making difficult decisions. I've heard stories about cities that had to put quite a bit into their volunteer fire relief system. They will have to before the end of 2010. And so what are they doing? Well, they're going to cut the fire department's budget. And I said, are you losing firefighters yet? Well, I haven't heard of them losing firefighters, but everyone's trimming back. And so some good things can come out of this, and I would tell this patient to exercise, sleep well. eat right, stay away from the legislature. No, I'm just kidding. And but there is stress going on. I would say the blood pressure is probably fairly high because you get nervous when they're not going to be able to respond to whatever amount they get cut by, and they know that there's challenges. And I think it's that long-term conversation that's going to have to occur. Now, the legislature's running for governor, the governor's running for president. Oh, sorry, that was kind of supposed to be funny. But anyway, it's really tough right now. You guys have a deficit. There'll be another one coming through. And of course, they're worried. Can I share one piece of data with you?
Sure.
That John actually took the numbers and played a little bit more with them today. Can you share those, John? Around, you know, there's been levy limits. There's been some different things. You want to talk about what makes the blood pressure go up. And he looked at, you know, going back a little ways and then coming forward and what does levy limits meant and all of that and property taxes and some of the different groups. And could he just share that with you real quickly?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You bet. Mr. Jernberg?
What they did, just to get a 10-year look, I looked at 99 and 2008. I didn't adjust anything for inflation, but just to see, I looked at property taxes, state LGA, state and total state aid, and I broke up our population groups into cities over 30,000, cities 10 to 30,000, cities 5 to 10,000, 4,000 to 2,500, 2,500 to 1,000, 900, 1,000 to 500, and less than 500, just to see how things broke down for these different types of cities, because they really operate differently depending on their population size. And from 1999 to 2008, cities that had the greatest property tax increases over that period of time were cities 2,500 and up. And those are cities that over that period of time during certain years had levy limits. And so for the largest cities, property tax increases over that time was 99%. For cities between 10 and 30,000 people, it was 115. For cities 2,500 to 5,000, it was 120%. For cities 2,500 to 5,000, it was 123%. But when you get below that, cities 1,000 to 2,500, the property tax increase was 45%. For 500 to 1,000, it was 66%. And less than 500, it was 81 or 82%. So those cities that had the smaller populations had levy limit and did not have levy limits actually raised their property taxes less than the larger cities. Mm-hmm. The cities that had the greatest reduction in LGA also had the highest levels of property tax increases. And I don't know, there's a lot of detail here, but in terms of levy limits, they haven't seemed to have kept the lid down on property taxes for those cities that had levy limits. Now, there are certain things you can get around the levy limits on, but just generally, it hasn't seemed to have had its intended effect.
Well, and I think when you look at, you know, special levies are not under levy limits, mm-hmm. and I think in seeing some statistics that to make up for the unallotments, there's about 55% of the property tax increase was under special levies, which are not under levy limits. So there's some wiggle room, certainly. And I think that the cities this year could have levied back $130 million, according to state law and levy limits, and it was like they levied back $90 million or something. It was less than that, so they didn't even go to the... It was less than what they could have, I know, and I don't know if those numbers are for sure. But any other comments or questions on kind of the state of the cities right now? Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I assume there's an electronic copy of this on the auditor's website? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Any other thing for the good of the order. Auditor Otto and Mr. Schoenberg, thank you so much. A lot of very, very good information. And as a bit of a prelude to next week, we're going to look at, I think, some redesign. We're going to be doing some redesigning here and looking at some proposals on redesign. So if you can think of some on your own, but hopefully we'll have a group here to talk about redesign if things work out good. So if there's nothing further for the good of the order, thank you so much. Have a good day. We are adjourned.
Thank you.